Representative Moniz.
Here.
Representative Nicholas.
Here.
Representative Stubson.
Here.
Senator Burns.
Here.
Senator Hassert.
Here.
Senator Perkins. Senator Wasserberger.
Here.
Co-Chairman Harshman.
Here.
Chairman Ross.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, you do have a quorum for purposes of reimbursement. Is Representative Larson?
Yes, sir.
Representative Schwartz?
Excused.
Representative Summers?
Here.
Representative Walters?
Here.
Representative Wilson?
Here.
Senator Dockstetter?
Excuse.
Senator Driscoll?
Here.
Senator Landon?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, you do have a quorum. One item of housekeeping. Senator Burns inquired about the reimbursement on Sunday, and I misspoke. You were not provided reimbursement on Sunday.
Nice job, Burns.
Why was I here? All right. So first up this morning is the Board of Parole, Dan Fesco, and floor is yours.
How's that?
Good.
For the record, my name is Dan Fetzko. I'm the executive director of the Wyoming Board of Parole. I'm here this morning with Gary Mitchell, former sheriff of Washakie County, former chairman of the Board of Parole, current parole board member. And I know there's some new members of the legislature here today observing, so I'll do a quick overview of the parole board, what we do, maybe give you a few facts that some data that we have from the last fiscal year that the committee hasn't heard yet. For those of you that don't know, the Wyoming Board of Parole is we're a small agency. We have a staff of seven, and we have seven parole board members appointed by the governor to serve six-year terms. You know, the geographic membership of the board is usually fairly diverse. We have members from all corners of the state. We travel to the penal institutions here in the state to conduct our parole hearings in person in three-member panels. So all seven members of the board don't go out at one time. We travel in three-member panels. That's per statute. And it only takes vote of two to either parole someone or deny someone parole. Every month we travel to at least one institution here in the state, sometimes two, twice a month, typically for 2 to 4 days at a time. And, again, we travel to the institution. So we go to Rawlins. We go to Torrington. We go to Riverton. We go to Newcastle. We also travel to the halfway houses in the state, the work release programs, or as they're commonly referred to as adult community correction centers, ACCs. We have those in Casper, Cheyenne, and Gillette. We'll also travel to those places and conduct hearings. So we travel a lot. The bulk of our 200 series budget is travel, and I'll talk about that here momentarily when I get to the dollars and cents. But so we're at, you know, these locations for 2 to 4 days at a time. You know, the members stay in hotel rooms. They get per diem like you all do. They, per statute, our board members are paid at the same rate as state legislators. And for every day they work, we pay them a day of prep time. During a typical day's hearing or a day of hearings, we'll conduct anywhere from 25 to 30 parole hearings, each one from anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes long, you know, depending on the circumstances. Some inmates' crimes are fairly straightforward, and they may be doing a great job in prison, and there's not a lot to discuss. In other cases, the crimes, you know, for the crime may be there may be extensive number of victims. There may be a lot of different issues. There may be family members who wish to come and speak to the board. But we're in hearings for long days. You know, we start early and finish late like you all do. And things don't run according to schedule all the time. There's security issues. But that's a typical day of us conducting hearings. And I describe parole hearings when I'm talking to the public with people. I guess the best analogy is that movie, The Shawshank Redemption. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but, you know, in a lot of states, they're so vast. In Texas, for instance, they have 150,000 inmates, and they have a parole board, I believe, with 15 members. It's larger than ours, and it's full-time, yet they don't have the time to meet with the inmates individually. It's such a large system that they conduct most all of their decisions based upon what we call a paper review or a file review. They don't actually sit down and talk to the inmate or talk to the victims. Typically, it's done remotely from an office someplace. We actually go into the prisons, typically in a classroom, or in Rawlins, the room that we use is, as I like to refer to it, is the execution chamber. There's never been anyone executed in that particular room, but that's what it's designed for, that and for training, and that's where we conduct our hearings in Rawlins. But we're in a room, and the board members are at a desk like we are very much now. They have their laptop computers, and I'll talk a little bit about it more, but over the years since I've been with the board, we've moved to an almost entirely paperless system where you know, it's created a lot of efficiencies, and it's saved time and money and resources. Before I began with the board, they would travel not only, you know, three of them to the institutions, but they would cart in boxes of file material that they would, you know, lug around with them everywhere. And I've been speaking with the Utah Parole Board recently, and they're still basically operating under that same system. I actually was kind of shocked to hear that one of our neighboring states, you know, with a larger population base, is yet quite a bit further behind the times than we are in the parole world anyway. They're still operating with the, you know, carrying the physical file to the hearings. We, you know, we have everything on laptops now, so. But it's the same thing. The inmate comes in and sits down in front of three parole board members, and it's a dialogue, you know, about whether or not that person is ready to reenter the society, whether or not they're going to be a risk to the public, whether or not they've addressed their criminogenic needs, you know, a variety of give and take. But that's the bulk of what we do. In the last fiscal year, we saw around 1,038 inmates. We typically hear over 1,000, anywhere from 1,000 to 1,100 a year. So when we go out to these hearings for the 2 to 3 days that we're there, we maybe hear anywhere from 60 to 100 inmates, you know, in person. And again, it adds up to around 1,100 a year. Last year of those, it was 1,038 last year. We paroled, I believe, 774 inmates in one shape or form. So right at about 75% of every inmate that we saw last year for parole, we granted them parole in one form or fashion. That doesn't mean that they all go right out to the streets by any means. In a lot of cases, we parole them upon completion of programming or some kind of educational or vocational treatment. We parole them to the halfway houses that I mentioned before. That's a very popular useful tool that we have in the state for those folks who don't have anywhere to go, or they don't have any job history, or they need some kind of transition. Or we do parole people, you know, right, you know, to the street in some form or fashion. Every year, roughly 150 of those parolees return to prison in some form or fashion as part of a revocation. They go out on parole. Before their sentence expires, they're unable to follow the rules of their parole, and unfortunately they're revoked. Last year that actually was up to 180, which I think is just a natural correlation between the fact we paroled more people than we ever have before. I don't know if I mentioned that, but in the entire time I've been with the Board of Parole, I believe that's the highest percentage easily that we've ever paroled this past fiscal year. So naturally revocations are a little bit higher. Revocations are up a little bit now, too. I know that Director Lampert, when the Department of Corrections appears after me, will probably mention it, or Deputy Director Lindley or one of their staff. But with the budget cuts, there's really no more money for jail sanctions, for intermediate sanctions for those folks who are out on parole, who maybe need something in between prison, but yet are not at that moment suitable for the community. We have some intermediate jail sanctions where the parole board could sanction a parolee to a county jail for up to 30 days. Kind of a wake-up call, you know, get them out of whatever environment they're in, you know, sober them up a little bit. But if they still have a job, you know, hopefully that family support, we keep that intact. Well, you know, that used to be the last step before revocation, and that's really not available anymore. So I think our revocations are climbing because of that. But that's the breakdown of the bread and butter of what we do. You know, last year, in terms of we see inmates and we grant or deny them parole, or when they're out on parole, we hopefully, you know, they don't come back for revocation. But that's another big part of what we do when we travel to Torrington or Lusk. That's where we conduct the revocation hearings. You know, beyond that, at the office, our staff of seven were, you know, we're busy all the time with, we're the direct liaison between the Department of Corrections and the parole board. So if there's any, well, for instance, if a parolee is going to be revoked, they call us up, to schedule a preliminary revocation hearing, with the parole board. And I'm a hearing examiner for purposes of those hearings. I conduct probable cause hearings. Or my deputy, we conduct probable cause hearings for all the parole violators around the state. We get correspondence, emails, phone calls from parole agents seeking modifications of parole or, any number of issues. A lot of what we do is just corresponding with the inmates and the parolees that write in to us with questions about their parole. I mean, that's a constant. I'm sure as you all know, we get a lot of correspondence from inmates and inmate family members. But that, that's the bread and butter of what we do. And a lot of it involves travel from all over the state to a lot of different places. So if you don't have any more questions at this point about, what the board does and the function of the board, which I'd be happy to answer. I enjoy talking about parole and reentry. I think it's critical to all of us. You know, we all go back to these communities. That's one thing that I talk about the public, speak to the public, is that, and you've probably heard this data before, it gets somewhat old, but still powerful, in that 95% of people who are in prison right now are getting out. You know, there's people doing life sentences, sure, but for the most part, everybody there is getting out, and most people want to go back to where their community was, where the crime was committed. They have family there. They have some tie there. So they're probably coming back to, right where they were. Some people want a fresh start, and I know the board hears that from time to time and finds it, I think, quite refreshing occasionally when people say, I don't want to go back to my old way of life,
Mr. Chair.
Friends.
Yeah. Hey, Dan, just a couple quick questions. Could you provide us with a sheet over the last 5 years, the number of parolees that you see and the number that have been released? Can you keep that running data so we can see it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
Actually, I believe, at least for the last 4 years, it is contained in our strategic plan, and it should be in our annual report.
I just want a one-sheeter that brings it on.
No problem.
And then could you provide us with the number of revocations over the course of those 5 years so we can see what trends and where it's going? And then, if it's possible, I'd like to know the number of those folks that are paroled, how many are Wyoming residents when they came in, and just so we have a better understanding of that. And then my last question would be, I'm curious about the capacity of the halfway houses and if there are any restrictions on who they take in those halfway houses. It's my understanding that there are certain types of crimes where they're not as cooperative to taking certain parolees and how they come out with. So if you could spend a little bit of time, just explain the halfway houses and what restrictions they have, how many beds are available there.
Sure. Chairman Ross, Representative Nicholas, with the halfway houses, I would have to defer to the Department of Corrections on the exact numbers, but I believe they have a contract. First of all, there's the halfway houses are run by private correctional companies that contract with the Department of Corrections. They're under, however, a community board, a county board, that's comprised of one district court judge, the prosecutor, public defender, somebody from with a criminal justice background or academic background. But they have a community board that's ultimately responsible for who gets in and who does not get in. And you are correct. There are certain crimes, for instance, sex offenses, or very violent crimes that will make it tougher for some of those individuals to get in. But on a case-by-case basis, I know that the individuals with crimes like that, violent crimes, are accepted. And I know that the Department of Corrections has some very excellent reentry agents that will go to the community boards. The community boards sit like any other board, and they review applications, and they make decisions based on a vote. However, some Department of Corrections staff will go and advocate on behalf of certain clients, to pitch a case for those individuals to be accepted. And again, I know some of those individuals with the more heinous crimes are permitted And last time I heard, I believe each facility has a contract for around 101 beds, where it fluctuates. They can go over maybe 120 or maybe down around 100 to 80. But, again, I would defer to the Department of Corrections, but I think each one's around 100 per ACC. But with regard to the numbers of, the parolees per year, how many we see, how many we grant, that's readily available. Same with the revocations. I'll probably have to work with the Department of Corrections a little bit to find out on the status of their citizenship, from which, if they're all from Wyoming. Because that's an interesting thing that I point out about most any of the data we get, is that we, at least the data that we get from the Department of Corrections, when somebody finishes their sentence and then they go out into mainstream society, if they leave Wyoming and commit new crimes, we may not know about that. I think the data we get is people that recidivate here in Wyoming and end up back in the Department of Corrections system. So there are some people, in the data stream who aren't captured because they're really not maybe from here originally, and when they get done with their crime, they don't come back. So,
Representative Conley.
Mr. Chair, and just to add on, Dan, I'm curious about the revocations, because they're expensive. If you send people back to prison, that's expensive. And so I'm curious about the number of those that are for crimes or for rule violations, like not drinking or things like that.
Chairman Ross, Representative Conley, we can drill down on that, too. I know that at least at the end of the last quarter, they are on the up. Tick too. Revocations were 180 last year, and I believe at the end of the first quarter of this particular year, this fiscal year, it would almost be double that. If it were to translate, I think we had 90 in the first quarter. I remember Deputy Director Lindley and I and Director Lamper were discussing it. At least the way that the revocations are starting out into this new year, they're up. So I'm actually, Representative Connolly, Professor Connolly, in discussions with some of the folks at the Criminal Justice Department about getting maybe an intern or two to go back and look at our revocation data from the last few years as well, to really drill down on not only, the type of violations, whether it involved new felonies or technical violations, or how long they were on parole before they were revoked. Like, how quickly is this happening? At what point? So there's some aspects of our revocations that I think certainly could bear further study.
Dan, when you're doing this, to what extent are you seeing parolees just saying, screw it, I just go ahead and eat my time and go back?
Chairman Ross, that's interesting, too, and we have seen a decrease in that from when I originally began with the parole board, and part of it was the good time system that was in place that, since I've been with the board, has been modified to address the problem on some level, I believe. When I first began with the board, about 40% of every inmate who had the option to come see the parole board was waiving the opportunity, and we had an intern from the University of Wyoming who came and studied the issue. And the overwhelming majority of the response was that a lot of people they didn't want to go out on supervision for fear of failure, or they didn't had to have anyone to tell them what to do. When they got out, they wanted to go back to drinking and drugging or whatever it was that their lifestyle, that led them to prison, and they just didn't want the supervision. There were some other reasons in there. That some of them had a fear of the parole board, frankly. They didn't want to go in front of the parole board and have to talk about their crime again or go through that process. But around that time, the way the good time was situated, there was no good time for going on parole at all. And inmates were getting 10 days of good time in the facility. So some inmates looked at it as a time savings proposition, that if I stay in prison and keep getting my inmate good time, I'll finish my sentence quicker than if I went out on parole. Now, to them, the benefit of being out breathing the free air and walking the streets was not enough, in those situations for some inmates to just stay in prison and kill their number. So through negotiations with the Department of Corrections and the governors, we created parole good time, which is now available at 20 days a month. And the inmate good time was raised to 15 days a month with the idea that it would be an incentive to take parole because they could still finish their sentence. Not only finish it at the same time as they would as an inmate, but quicker. And that reduced our waiver rate to around a quarter. I'd like to revisit it just to see what the waiver rate is again. But Chairman Ross, on some level, I think that's, you know, what you're going to get when you deal with a population of inmates. I mean, I've not been a parole board member, but I've traveled with them when I was the deputy of the parole board to every hearing for probably 7 years. So as I mentioned, we do 1,000-some hearings a year. I've probably seen over 5,000 parole hearings. And I believe in the power of human change. I've seen men and women come in who, frankly, prison saved their life. You know, they got out of whatever downward spiral they were in, and they you know, cleaned up and got some education and decided they want to change their life, and they've been successful about it. But there's that certain element, too, that they, you know, it may be the age thing. You know, a lot of young offenders are not done with the game yet, as you might say. They're not ready to retire. And so you're going to have a certain percentage of offenders that aren't interested in parole, or and I think that's going to be systemic part of the system. But, again, my message is that for the majority of people, in my opinion, you know, they want the same thing as everyone else. They want to get out and, you know, they want to meet somebody and, you know, start a family maybe, buy a house, get a truck. I mean, I've heard people communicate this in parole hearings that I just want to get out and, you know, try to start a productive life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but in any event.
Okay. Any other questions before? Dan, what we do is we just kind of go through each page of your supplemental budget, and we'll go through there.
All right. Well, again, we're a fairly small agency with 7 staff and 7 members, and our budget, like everyone else's, is now has shrunk. Prior to the cuts that we made, you know, with through the governor, our transportation budget had been reduced from, at least out of state or in state, from roughly $290,000 to $232,000. So we cut our transportation budget by nearly 25% before we got to the cuts that are part of this supplemental budget. Our in-state travel was also cut by our out-of-state travel, excuse me, was also cut by roughly $3,000. So that's the first reduction that I'd like to start with, would be in the 200 series, if that's okay. I'll begin wherever you wish, Chairman Ross. But with that particular object code, out-of-state travel, every year the board, since I've been with the board and the deputy director and the director, we all travel to our annual training conference, which is put on by the Association of Paroling Authorities International. It's actually an international professional parole association with the United States dominating, I guess, the membership. However, there are 34 other nations that are part of it. And the conference is typically in the U.S., but actually this year it's in Vancouver because Canada, the Parole Board of Canada, is on the committee. And it's pretty interesting, Canada. They have such a centralized government that they have the Parole Board of Canada. And it's not over any province. It's over the whole nation. And in order to get this conference approved, we have I'm on the executive committee for this organization, APAI. I'm the recording secretary. So I take the minutes of the monthly meeting, and one of our members is from Canada. So I'm digressing, but in order to get that conference approved in Vancouver this year, they had to actually get permission from the prime minister. So as our meeting, we're like, well, we got to wait till, you know, she gets back, hold of the prime minister, and says we can have the conference. But anyway, we used to send our full board, all 7 members and 2 executive staff, to the conference. And it's our equivalent of professional education. You know, we get to collaborate with the other parole boards from around the nation and the U.S. or the globe, essentially. And as part of our budget, we're going to scale way back on who we send to that. We're only going to send our chairman and myself. So we have proposed to remove $19,000 from our out-of-state travel, which it was originally $34,000. This will now cut it down to about $11,600. And, again, that's the primary cut with that code, is that we're going to cut way back on who we send to our annual conference, and we'll try to make up for that by the members that do go. We'll try to train them on what we've learned or what we've been exposed to. And most of those conferences, anything's on a flash drive anymore, so you can
Senator Burns.
When you go to this, are you taking the state jet?
Chairman Ross, Senator Burns, no, we fly commercial, so that's part of it, yeah.
You do have, follow-up, please. You do use make quite a bit of use of the state jet for your hearings around the state.
Chairman, Senator Burns, yes, sir, we do.
Which accounts for the large in-state travel. Do you know happen to know how much YDOT charges you for that jet?
I believe it, at one point it was $12.50 an hour. Is that correct now? It was up to $1,500 an hour at one point, but it's somewhere in that range, Senator Burns.
Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Wasserberg.
That was my question.
All right. Okay, there we go.
The next code, the 200 code, 207, we would decrease that by 10,000. Again, a lot of that was registration for the conference. The conference is a few hundred bucks for everybody involved. We also, we have a young lady in our office who's our victim service coordinator, and she has gone back to school to get her master's, and she's specializing in victimology and counseling for victims. And under that code, we are actually reimbursing her for some of her tuition as part of, you can do that through, it's permissible through, several state agencies have done it over the years. If the education is related to the work at hand, you can reimburse them for part of the tuition. However, we've quit doing that for her as part of that. So that's part of the savings in that particular code. With 230 and 231, those are both printing and supplies, where we've offered to cut back by $8,000 and $6,000 respectively there. I've been monitoring these, and we're under budget still with these cuts, although it's definitely tighter. But a lot of the – we would revert money back in both of those categories. And, again, a lot of that is attributable to the we're just going more and more paperless, you know, most every new person that comes in now has an entire paper file. There's no more physical file where you go into a file cabinet and look for it. I mean, we don't have the expense for manila, you know, cardboard file folders or all the paper. I mean, it's just we're more – and so it's – over the years, that has – that's reduced. So that's the code there. With the 223 for the permanent vehicle, we have a Yukon that we use. A lot of times when the board does fly around, for instance, let's say they're flying to Torrington – we'll drive up there in our state vehicle, and then, you know, we pick them up, and then we take them to the prison or wherever it is. We have that vehicle. It's paid off, so we're not going to get a new vehicle, and we're going to keep using that vehicle. So we're going to return or, cut some money there. We still need a little bit of money for the maintenance and, you know, things like that, but that's one of the cuts there. With equipment repair and maintenance, we've offered to slash 1,800 of that. We really, most all of our, like, for instance, the copier, things that seem to need repairs, those are covered under contract. We really don't have anything that we need to repair that comes up that isn't, again, already covered somehow. And then the biggest cut that we've come to is this relates, I guess, to the greater efficiencies that we're finding in terms of, you know, cutting back on paper, but not only that, cutting back on staff time. We have one staff member who was ready to retire, and frankly, she's quite exceptional. She's always, you know, volunteering to help people and train people and knows the office backward and forward. And she was getting ready to retire, but she mentioned that she would, you know, consider working if she could work less, half time. And all of these cuts we discussed with the board, by the way, I have member Mitchell here with me, and it was suggested, well, maybe we could convert that to a half-time position. And the board agreed with that, and our staff person was excited about the idea of staying on for a while. So we've reduced that position to a half-time position, which cut the $59,000 that you see there, along with $35,000 in health insurance benefits. And what we're going to do now, what we actually have begun doing is – we're studying that position. There's two positions. We have, again, a staff of seven, myself, a deputy director, a business office coordinator, a victim service coordinator, a board recording secretary travels with the board to record all the hearings, and then two parole board assistants. And their primary, they're essentially file clerks. And all the information that comes in on inmates and parolees, they maintain files on. And again, over the years, we've been moving to such a paperless system that there's less work that goes along with those jobs. Some of the job duties associated with those file clerk positions have also been assumed by the victim service coordinator. So in studying the position, and I've told my staff this, I mean, the idea is it may be that that we don't need that position altogether. And that would be my, I guess, my what I would offer to you is that I'd like to look at it, and by the next session coming, you know, maybe that's something that – a position that could be removed. But in terms of our staff, it's a small staff, and that was an efficiency that, you know, that we believe that we could handle. In fact, we're handling quite well, at least from – you know, my perspective without, you know, getting some data on it or having them – my idea – what we're doing is we're having them record their time like a law firm. Like, I want to know exactly how much time during the day you're spending on this and, you know, this area and this job duty. And, you know, at the conclusion of that, I'd like, you know, to know whether or not we would even need that half-time position any longer. And then, you know, I guess the big – the other area of our budget, again, as Senator Burns mentioned, is the in-state travel. I mean, we do use the plane. I've discussed it with the committee before. If we didn't use the plane and we did have to drive to all the hearings, it would save some money, but not as much as you would think at first, because it's not like we use the plane frivolously or that we're flying around, you know, taking down to Scottsdale to go golfing before we start them. You know, it's a bad joke. I apologize. But, I mean, most of the times we're up at 4 in the morning and we're flying in the dark, and those planes are frigid cold when you get on them. And we fly around to exotic places like, you know, Evanston and Worland, and, you know, we land in Torrington, and it's all in the dark. And then, you know, then we go and we conduct hearings all day long. And at the end of the last day, we conduct hearings right up till 5 or 6 o'clock, and then we get on a cold plane again and fly through the dark, and people are still driving home when they get off, you know, off the plane at like 9, 10 at night. I mean, so what it does, it saves us time, but it does save the members having to drive a day on the front end, a day on the back end, having to pay them salary those days, having to pay the hotel, the per diem. I mean, it does add up to where it's not I mean, there certainly is, you know, an argument to be made that there's quite a bit of benefit to use the plane. Not only that, it attracts quality board members. I know we have a few board members. For instance, one of our latest board members is Owen Peterson, whom you all may know as a former legislator. And he's in Mountain View, and he drives to Evanston to take the plane. But for him to drive from Mountain View to, like, Lusk or, you know, Torrington in the winter, he's, you know, it's not something that he's excited to do.
Right.
And the plane certainly helps us attract people like that. I mean, he's a skilled attorney. He was a former legislator. And there was no learning curve with him. When he came on the board, he was ready to go and just sit down and conduct hearings. He was very comfortable with the process, very professional. And, you know, he's been wonderful to have on the board. But having the use of that helps us attract that kind of board member.
Okay. Other cuts?
I believe I went over them.
Any questions?
Yes. I didn't want you to misinterpret the thrust of my question. My curiosity on your question wasn't your use of the jet. I understand the extensive use, and frankly, I appreciate it. The thrust of my question was aimed more at how much YDOT's charging you.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Moniz.
Did I hear you say you take your tuition out of travel as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moniz, no, sir, that came out of the registrations, conferences, training,
okay,
out of that area.
And what percentage of your travel budget is the state plane?
That's an excellent question. It's well over 50. I would say it's probably in the range of around 75 to maybe 60 to 75%. I mean, it does cost quite a bit. But again, if we didn't have the plane, a lot of that cost would be made up for, you know, in increases in per diem and hotel and salary that we had to pay the board for those extra days. But it's what we do. I mean, I explained to a lot of folks that I almost feel like we're a traveling circus. You know, we show up at the prisons and we walk in with our laptops and all of our, you know, we set up shop in one of their classrooms, and for 3 days we conduct, parole hearings, and they're all, you know, serious, you know, kind of high stake hearings. You know, it's a pretty stressful environment. As I sit there through sometimes hearings all day, I forget about it. They start to seem routine to me, and then, you know, we see the inmate shaking in his chair and he's talking to the board, and that's another reason I'm a firm believer in the fact that we conduct in-person hearings with the inmates. I mean, you really, not that you can read somebody's mind or get to know them in 15 minutes, but it's hard to replace, you know, what you can learn about somebody face-to-face versus what you get on a telephone or in a paper review. But I'm getting off track. I apologize.
Yeah. Yes.
Kind of a side question. One of the things we've noticed in the last 8-9 years is the fact that prisoners are staying in the prisons here longer than they were 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Have you tracked any? Is there any reflection of that in the parole board? Are the number of parole denials has that gone up at all? Has that remained kind of steady?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, I'd say it's somewhat steady, but this year, as I mentioned at the outset, it's the number of denials has gone down as low as I've ever seen it, and the number of grants are up as high as I've ever seen it.
So the denial rate has actually dropped.
It has.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you for what you do, and I know it's important work, and you do it with a pretty slim staff, so we appreciate your efforts and appreciate you presenting here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chairman. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Yeah. Okay. We'll switch gears here and we'll move to budget number 80, which is Department of Corrections. And I believe first up is a kind of a report on the penal facilities. I know that Speaker Brown wanted a few moments to address the committee, and so come on up.
Chairman, are you presenting the report? I was going to speak on it. I'm not necessarily presenting the report.
Who is presenting the report?
I thought you were.
Oh, okay. I guess I am.
So okay. There are a few things I want to say about it, but I take all the help I'm getting. Senator Pro Chairman. Bruce, probably going to need your opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm Bruce Burns. Mr. Chairman, the task force met, and the specific dates are in the
report.
I didn't want to get into an extensive report on it because you can go ahead and read it. But we have three members of this committee that served on the task force. Four, including myself, Senator Hastert, Senator Wasserberger, and Representative Burkhart. So I'm sure they can give you their opinions on the report. If you want to go, and I want to go over this fairly quickly, you can get the background and the summary and so forth. I want to go to page 11.
Okay.
And that's where we start getting into the problems of the penitentiary and why they're having it. We've got walls that are out of true, we've got cracks, huge cracks. We've got doors that are out of plumb, so they can't be opened or closed. And apparently, that's fairly important at a penitentiary. And so, We hired some experts to come in and try and figure out why this is all going on. And so on page 11, it gets into it. And basically, the foundations of the south facility were constructed using a concrete straight shaft drilled piers embedded into bedrock, and the ground level floors are concrete slabs on grade. And that's where we've really had the problem, are these slabs on grade. The property consists of four buildings, and it goes west to east. And the ones on the far east, like the K unit and the CPF, they've had their problems that have actually been relatively simple. They're just settling, and they're the most simple to fix. You just mediate that. The more complex problem we're having are in the west end, where the south unit is, because those soils there expand. And it's similar to the problem we had with the north unit. Basically, in very simplistic terms, the north unit was a bad plan that was badly executed. They saw the expansive soils when they were building the south unit, and they actually made a good plan to account for it, but it was badly executed. That's the simplest term for it. If you look on page 11 on paragraph 2, about halfway down, says most of the damage in the south facility is related to upward movement on the concrete slabs on grade. So we've got, on the west side, we've got upward movement. On the east side, we've got settling. And then down to paragraph 4, the primary cause of the distress occurring in the Wyoming Penitentiary is differential vertical movement of the concrete slabs on grade, and to lesser extent, the vertical movement of foundation elements and the heaving of expansive soils below the buildings. The other problem has been drainage, the water coming off the building itself. It was not graded correctly, and so the water has been seeping back into the foundations of the buildings. So when they were designing the south unit, to take into account the heaving and expanding the soils, they decided to design void spaces, is what they call it. And if you picture corrugated cardboard and you look in there, that's basically what the void spaces were. So when the soil expanded, it would expand up into those void spaces. Well, what happened was during construction, the contractor wanted to use what they call mud slabs, which are basically concrete slabs that were put on the bottom part of where those corrugated cardboard was. They were told, okay, you can do that as long as you don't overlap the bottom of the steel itself, the bottom part of the corrugation. Well, they did. And it actually, and we have pictures of it, and overlapped about 6 inches on each one. So what that essentially did was it sealed off those void spaces. So the void spaces became useless. They stayed empty. So as the ground expanded, it pushed up on those slabs. And that's one of the basic problems we've had with this. And as I said, I'm doing this in very simple terms. So the and Mr. Speaker, please interrupt me at any time. So basically, the task force got together, looked at this problem, and looked at various solutions. And you can go to page 13 to see what the potential solutions were. There were options 1, 2A, 2B, 3A, 3B, and 4. And those options consisted of everything from A, which was just to repair the south facility and the buildings, all the way up to 4, which was to rebuild the entire state penitentiary at a different location, preferably north of Rollins, where the soil is much more stable. Where the task force ended up coming down was the majority voted to go with option 1, which is to fix the current facility where it is. You can see the table on page 14. It is the cheapest option, but we have assurances. One of the task force members that I relied on whose opinion I relied on is Senator Pappas, who's fortunately here with us. He is an architect, so he knows more about this than I do. Where the split in the opinion of the task force came down, I think, was between option one and options one and four. I don't think anybody wanted two or three in any form. I don't think anybody voted for that or proposed that. So the majority came down for repair. A minority came down for replacement of the entire facility. And with that, that's a very short pencil sketch of the task force, okay. Of the task force report. And with that, I would like to make room here for while the speaker's addressing us, I would ask Senator Pappas to come up here and give us his opinion.
Go ahead, Mr. Speaker.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there's just a few points out of this task force report that I want to make because I won't be back. And there are some things in here that are really important for the legislature to take forward. Number one, Senator Burns is exactly correct about the options. I really favored in the beginning, I was adamant that we were going to get out of that lake bed down there and go build in a new spot. And I thought one way we could do it is the warden testified that they could serve meals out of the existing kitchen in the south facility for up to 10 miles away. And so if we wanted to, we could start a new campus north of Rawlins, and there are some sites in here that are have been investigated. We could start a new campus north of Rawlins, and we could migrate our way up there over time, and we could use the existing kitchen and the existing laundry facility while we did the construction of the first phase north of town, and then we could begin to migrate, and eventually we'd have to build a new kitchen and a new laundry in the north facility, but that could be some time off in the future. After the work was done on this, I became convinced, and I was about the only one more adamant than me that we ought to get out of there was probably Representative Miller, who's a geologist, and he is just dead set that we ought to be out of there. However, we received this report from Martin and Martin, and they have done a lot of work, and they are convinced, they absolutely swear this will work. Senator Pappas says that this fix will work. Another individual on the committee was Copper France, who's president of the Bank of Commerce in Rawlins. He was a governor appointee, and before he came home to run the family bank, he worked for these same engineers designing prisons in expansive soil, and he says this will work. So there's three independent sources, well, not independent, but three related sources there that I guess have convinced me this will work. And when you're looking at $85 million against $250 million, in the situation that we're in, I think that's pretty weighty. A couple of more points. On page 13, in paragraph 3, we talk about the various areas that were investigated. After we went out there and looked at it, the one that I don't think got sufficient attention is section 29. And we didn't drill that section, so we don't know what's there, but it appears to be stable. The highway runs through Section 29. The advantage of Section 29 is we wouldn't have to do any business with the feds at all. Any of the others, we're going to be into EISs. We've got a trail through there called the Rawlins to Fort Washakie Trail that none of us had ever heard of that has to be mitigated. And every other solution north of Rawlins for a new facility involves some interaction with the feds. And as soon as you get into that, you get into EISs and FONSIs and whether there's significant impact or not, and you're into a long regulatory drill that might take longer than we have before we have to do something. And Section 29 deserves further investigation because it might be the solution and would leave us with an option that didn't require any participation from the feds. And the only other thing, Mr. Chairman, that I really wanted to harp on, and I really worked hard on this, is on page 16, oversight, design, and maintenance requirements. And if I don't leave any other legacy out of this whole thing with the legislature as I walk out, I would just leave you with the points that are here. Because we have, and it's not just the penitentiary, we've seen the same thing with the Capitol, we've seen the same thing with construction at UW, and I tried to put in here the salient points that we need to take away about how we've done construction in the past and how we need to do it in the future. And we need to have involvement at a higher level in the executive and legislative branch in the planning and in the selection of the professionals. We need to be sure that we're only allowing bids from, we got to take the lowest bid, but we only allow bids from qualified bidders. We need to pre-qualify bidders in terms of whether they can do the job or not, whether they have the capability, and then let, and then take the lowest of those bids. But don't just let every Tom, Dick, and Harry in, because you get some bidders in there, and then you're obligated to take the lowest price, and there are people that are unqualified. Construction oversight and management has been lacking in the past. You could see it in the construction of the South Unit and what the engineers found. And we need to find a way that architects that designed the project are involved in oversight of the project through the entire construction phase. We need to involve structural engineers and geotechnical engineers, and we need to have on-site people. And I think in the past the state has really cut corners there on construction oversight. That's how we end up with these voids that Senator Burns discussed that ended up being filled with a concrete slurry, and it totally neutered the thing. The second, the South Unit was correctly designed. Had the builder built it the way it was designed, we don't think we'd be here with these problems. And most of these fixes are to go back and retroactively undo what the builder did wrong and make the thing work the way it's supposed to work. And that's just a failure on our part to do the proper construction oversight that we ought to be doing. And Representative Burkhart has the most diabolical scheme of all, and the more I've thought about it, the more I think it's brilliant. He says award the contract to the lowest bidder and award the construction oversight to the next lowest bidder. And the next lowest bidder is going to say, look, you outbid me on this. You're going to build this the way you said you were. And I'm here to tell you, I know the project as well as you do, and I'm going to see that you do it. And I think it's brilliant. And the other thing, the last point we make is the state has to be cautious, and we are back in that, and it just warrants an extra level of oversight and caution when you get into what we call highly sophisticated or highly specialized construction, or this tricky sort of stuff. And you can't do this tricky stuff and then just do maybe a minimal amount of oversight. If the state's going to do this kind of stuff, then we have to have proper oversight of the construction. And if we don't, then we deserve what we get. I think I'll cut it off right there, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions for Speaker Brown? Or Senator Pappas, words from you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a couple of clarifying points I'd like to make. As far as the design on the South facility, the geotechnical report back when they did that project really recommended a different system than we ended up designing. They did allow an alternate system, the slab-on-grade system, but that was not the system that was actually recommended. A structural floor system was what was recommended. Right now, the facility is on drilled piers and grade beams, all the structural walls, exterior walls and roof and all the structure. And those are performing well. They found out of the piers that they tested only one cracked pier out of many. So that is not near as bad. And the only problems plaguing the actual grade beam and pier system is the mud slab issue that was just discussed. And if those are repaired, the actual structure of the facility is fine and is performing well. Where the problem was the slab on grade system, as Senator Burns mentioned, where all the slabs are heaving. Well, that was not the preferred method in the report. And it said, the report said, if you wanted to assume some risk, then you could do this alternate system. Well, I think the state assumed the risk and we're paying for it now. So if we would have just spent the extra dime to build structural floors, then we wouldn't be here today. But that being said, after we had the report from Martin and Martin, Wyoming, our engineers that investigated the site and the failing walls. They concluded that it could be repaired sufficiently that we could get a we could get our 50-year lifespan of the building back. I looked at the repairs. They're using what are called geopiles, 5-inch geopiles, geopiers that are drilled 25, 30 feet down into the ground, and they support a structural slab. So we're going back to the structural slab theory. We're not spanning to the grade beams, but we're actually putting small geopiles under the slab to hold it up. We've used this quite frequently. We're using them right now on the High Altitude Performance Center. We used it at on the police department downtown Cheyenne. We added two more stories onto that building. Only way to do that is with geopiles and taking care of the foundation. So it's a proven method. I'm very comfortable. The engineers were very comfortable in being able to bring this building back to the point where it can be usable without having to worry about doors not opening and closing. Also, the cost versus building a new prison is dramatically different, as you can see. And I want to caution the committee, though, that those dollars that you see in there, the $87 million versus the $250-some million, those are not going to be the final dollar amounts. Please understand that. Those were numbers from the engineer. They didn't include fees. They didn't include FF&E. They didn't include all sorts of things. You could probably add 20 or 30% to that by the time you add all that. I would also caution you that if we do decide to build a new prison, that there will be scope creep. Right now, if you repair this prison, you're stuck with the square footage you've got. You're not going to build any additional building. But I know, I've experienced it with lots of my clients, that when we decide to build a new building, we'll want to look at newer thoughts in correctional programming, and we'll want to put another program in. We'll want to enhance the space. We need to bring it to code as far as square footage is. Who knows what? But I can assure you that the building footprint will probably grow. So, anyhow, those are my thoughts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nicholas.
A couple different things. First of all, the I've heard two reasons why the the problem with the slab on grade. I heard that that it was the contractor that came in and just simply did it, contrary to the plans. And now I get a story that no, it's actually they had some communication with the oversight folks from the state of Wyoming who said go ahead and do it. So that's I'm curious on which it is.
Mr. Chairman, I can clarify that. The problem that was done wrong was the mud slabs. Okay, they mud slabs are, when the weather is really bad, the contractors want to. They have to build footings in mud. So what they ask for is a lean concrete mix, pour a real thin slab so they can build their forms on. Okay? And this was actually a change order request that the contractor wanted. The structural engineer at the time, I read the documentation, allowed the mud slabs. They required only an inch and a half mud slab, and they required it only for the width of the footing, which is the width of the grade beam, which is also the width of the void form. They installed it improperly. First, they went thicker. It was almost 4-5-inch slab, and they went wider than the grade beam, which means that it actually now acted as a footing because it wasn't the same width as the void form. If it was the same width as the void form, then it wouldn't have put any undue pressure on the grade beam. But since it was wider, it's picking up all that surface area, and it's acting as a beam transferring the load to the grade beam. So that's where the contractor went wrong. Where I believe the state failed is they allowed the wrong system to be installed. So it's a two-part failure here, as far as I'm concerned.
So, and then the next follow-up question, Mr. Chair, is, so you're suggesting that the price of this to do the modifications is going to be between $115 and $125 million all told, and not, so that the 87 is just a kind of a quick number, but it doesn't include all of the cost components of it. Kind of like what we have with the Capitol building. The problem is you throw out a number and people want that number to stick against the wall, but if we're going to throw out a number, we're talking at least $120 million or something to that effect. Is that would
that's
that be
true?
Fair?
That's true, Mr. Chairman. That's true, and I believe Speaker Brown actually made that point clear in our committee meetings that this number is not the final number. That was the number the consultant put in the report. And he wanted to make sure that that number didn't stick because just like other projects, it's not the big picture. You have to put in all the soft costs. You have to put in, you know, all the FF&E. You have to put in whatever costs that the owner may have in moving people. All those costs are not taken in consideration.
And so if you put in all the costs that you think ought to be put in, what number is it?
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that anybody's really done that exercise yet. We were guessing at 30 to 40%. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that before we as a body consider which option to go, we need to know what that number is going to be.
Speaker.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that's certainly correct. You need to know the number. I went out of my way in that hearing to admonish the press that they were to take this number and tie this thing around our neck, which is what they did on the Capitol. They took the first number that was a back of an envelope figure, and ever since on the Capitol, somebody's been screaming that the cost is going up, the cost is going up, and that's not really fair because it was never a real number to start with. And so it was above that number, but that number didn't stand for anything. And so I admonished the press that they weren't to take this number. And we can't tell you today, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, we can't tell you today what that number is because that's going to require some additional work that was beyond what we could get done. I'm not sure it was beyond our scope, but we only had less than a year to do it, and we just couldn't get it all done. So we've moved it as far as we could, and we've got that base number of $87 million, but you have to listen to the cautions that Senator Pappas throws in there that number is going to be refined as the drawings are worked out and all that stuff that we've been through with the Capitol and then the additional things that maybe aren't in there. It's a good starting point, but it's not something that it would be fair to say is the number and budget for that number and then start going berserk when it rises above it.
And then finally, Mr. Chairman, in terms of making these corrections, what's the life of the facility when we make those in, and how did that play into building a new one? If it's a 30, obviously if it's only 20 years, and if a new one's 50 years, then there's your component of money, and how do you make that assessment in terms of cost?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the consultant certainly indicated that we would restore the buildings. Lifespan, which was 50 years. However, there is, speaking with them offline, there is no reason to believe that it couldn't exceed the 50 years with proper maintenance. Once you put a structural system in that's performing well, there's typically nothing that will degrade if things are maintained with proper maintenance. So as far as the structure and the ability for the building to be operational, I think it would be well past 50 years because of the type of construction it is. Now, whether our program will change in 50 years, that's up to the correctional community.
Senator, with regard, when you're talking about these other costs, I may assume that you may have to move. Does it include moving inmates or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, the idea for repairing would not be to repair the entire facility in one phase. That would be too costly because we would have to move prisoners to another state, basically. at a very high cost. Each one of those pods that we would remodel, we would do, each pod would be a phase. And I believe there's 160-some prisoners in each pod. And the Department of Corrections says they have enough capacity within the state to be able to take 160 prisoners and put them in other pods and other locations around the state. So we wouldn't have those kind of costs. But we would have phasing costs, which means that the construction would be spread over a longer period of time. Obviously, if you could mobilize your construction crews one time and get it all done, that would be cheaper.
Right.
But it would be too cost prohibitive to do that for us because of the displacement of the inmates.
Okay. Sure. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Speaker, I guess if I'm understanding correctly, the task force here is just reporting basically what you've identified and possible solutions, but I would think that this process would then move forward with a level 2 feasibility study and the level 3 design to where we could actually get some accurate projections of what the costs were going to be. We'd probably need to rat hole some money to allow us to do those things, but would it not follow that normal process to ensure that we've got the right projections down?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, that's exactly right, and that's the way it would go. And I think the one thing that I would stress in here, back to the first question that Representative Nicholas asked, how was this decision made? We had a soils report. We went back and looked at the soils report, and they said, it didn't just say assume risk. It said if the state wanted to assume substantial additional risk, then instead of suspending the whole thing on grade beams that were on top of pylons, you could go inside of those and put in slab on grade. But they were going to float up and down at a different rate and a different way than the beams were. And then the other thing that was stressed in there is if you're going to do that, for whatever you do, don't put a structural wall that's partly on the beam and partly on the slab, because they're going to move differently, and that's where the big crack in the gym wall came from. So my point in all that is when those decisions are made, I think we need to have a higher level of executive branch and legislative branch involvement. We went back and got testimony from the architect. We had the guy from Plan One in Jackson come down, and I had an opportunity to discuss that decision with the gentleman who was the governor at the time, and nobody can clearly tell me how that decision was made to assume all that substantial additional risk. And a decision of that magnitude can't be delegated to staff. I think that has to involve legislative and executive leadership, hands-on, when those kind of decisions are made, which would be in your phase two, and when you get into your planning phase, you've got to be involved.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Thank you. Just a couple things for the committee. The cells themselves are part of the structure of the building. And I think that needs to be clear. It's not that the cells themselves are settling into the ground or breaking in half or anything. The door issues have to do with the floors outside the cells. Right now the pen is still where the cells are structurally sound. Additionally, if I could add to what Senator Pappas said, part of that original change order was to remove those mud sills prior to backfilling, and if I remember, that was not done. And I think that's a good point to having massive oversight on a project of this level. And further, I would recommend that, you know, considering the costs, the technical aspects of this, that during session we have a meeting for all the legislators with Martin and Martin, similar to what we did with the Capitol, so they understand these issues. And I think, my own opinion, the cost is going to go a lot higher than $87 million. I agree with Senator Pappas. We just don't know what that number is. We really don't know what's under the ground completely yet. So,
I think Representative Connolly, and then Representative Larson, and then Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I've got a question for Mr. Speaker and Senator Burns as the co-chairs of the task force. when we put together this bill and talked about it, we talked a lot about what the options were. And what I see is a very good report that talks about what went wrong at the Rollins facility and then what it would cost to fix it or build a new prison. But when we were talking about this issue, part of the task force job was to think about what the current and future inmate populations are and also to think about alternatives to incarceration. And if I remember correctly, we received many, many sheets on how much it costs for things like intensive supervised probation, for us to have a different kind of correctional system that didn't rely on kind of bricks and mortar and incarceration. And we spent a lot of time on this committee thinking about that as part of what your role would be on the task force. And so I'm curious and a little honestly disappointed that what we got was a portion of what we asked you to do, and a good portion, right? But not that other portion which would have given us a real alternative to bricks and mortar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Connolly, there's two answers to that. Number one is, we just flat didn't have time to do to go that far, and so we tried to focus our efforts where we felt that they would pay the best dividend in the time we had. The second one is that many of those questions get into legislative debates, and they're open to a lot of difference depending on what legislative decisions are made about those. And I sort of made a decision early on that we weren't going to get in the business of picking winners and losers. And so we weren't going to look at some of those things simply because I think those are questions the legislature is just going to have to answer. And I don't think that we could.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. But, Mr. Speaker, you are giving us a report that has us spending between $127 and $300 million when we are in these economic times. There are some alternatives out there. And at a bare minimum, I would suggest that the task force recommend that we continue to do what we required, honestly, the task force to do in that Senate file. I mean, we've got a portion of the answer here, but only a portion. And I don't want to spend $300 million or even half of that when there are alternatives out there that weren't explored.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Don't you agree or not?
Mr. Chairman, my only response is a lot of those are legislative decisions and how you want to handle those prisoners, where you want to put them, what the incarceration rate's going to be, and all those sorts of things. And this task force ends the end of this month. It has an expiration on it. So we could only do what we could do, and as I say, we tried to stay out of things that I think are going to have to be decided by the legislature.
Senator Burns.
You're talking on page 4, which is the enabling legislation. And I think what you're drawing attention to, Mr. Chairman, is the alternatives to incarceration, timeframes, so forth. I would probably have agreed on looking more into that if we were dealing with any of the other facilities, if we were had this situation with Torrington, Newcastle, or Riverton. But this is the maximum security penitentiary in the state of Wyoming. There are people down there. Well, one was on death row. There may still be. We're talking about people, at least 24 are life without parole, and then there's other people there for life. That's what they've been sentenced to. They haven't been sentenced to looking for alternatives and wearing an ankle bracelet or something. So, frankly, I did not look at the idea of alternatives to incarceration for this. I was looking at this particular institution and whether to replace it or repair it.
Just, some pushback there. Part of the discussion that happened when we were discussing the legislation was building out Torrington. That was one of the options that was talked about. The task force decided not to go there, but if we were going to build out Torrington, that meant that there was the possibility of doing something with the current inmates in Torrington, which is not a maximum security facility. And so one of the options at that point was Torrington. And so then we have the option to think about alternatives to incarceration for the men that are in Torrington, as well as some of the women in Lusk or whatever. There were options that we talked about 4 months ago that we don't see in here.
Mr. Chairman?
I don't want to get into a debate here.
No, I am answering the question. I don't want to debate.
Wait. One person at a time, and okay. I'll control it. Go ahead, and then we're going to go to Representative
Lusk. The idea of moving the entire thing out of Rollins to Torrington was discussed, but it wasn't discussed to any great extent. The consensus of the task force, and it maybe it's just the personalities on there, was to keep the facility or a facility Rollins.
Okay. I know that Speaker Brown has got another appointment. Is there anything further you wish to weigh in on?
I don't, Mr. Chairman. I've got just a minute if anybody's got a burning question for me.
Mr. Speaker, I do have one question for you before you go. The governor has asked for a contingent funds of roughly $19 million in case there's some type of a catastrophic event. And so I just wanted to get your input on what the propriety there or the realistic likelihood of something like that happening, and if it's something we need to appropriate out of or contingently appropriate out of the LSRA, or if it's more likely that with the $13 million that's out there to kind of bring things back to order, that will take care of the problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the governor was wise to propose that. I don't know that I'm the person to answer whether it ought to be debited against LSRA. Seems to me maybe that'd be okay. But the point is there are serious structural problems there right now, and they're attempting to address them. But it's a little bit dicey and a little bit unpredictable, and I think the governor just wanted a contingency there that facility, if we don't get cracking and get something done, that facility in a fairly rapid manner could be unusable and the prisoners have to go somewhere.
Mr. Chairman. We finally get to you, Representative Larson.
I get it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so the discussion that I'm hearing, Mr. Chairman, is somewhat reflective of what we've gone through with the state health facilities, the Life Resource Center, and the state hospital. And to make the decisions that Representative Conley was wanting answered is part of the process that would move forward in the level to feasibility study and the design study. That's how you determine what you're going to do with those populations, if and when and how you move them. My question, Speaker, is as we look at that process, that may be an additional 2 years down the road to do the feasibility study and then a design, and that's aggressive. Do we have that time?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, we think we do. However, I think the governor's trying to hedge our bet a little bit and say that he wants to put in place a contingency in case what we think can be done turns out not to be accurate.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, the issues are that the building is going to continually move as we're designing or whatever we're planning to do. And so, the problems are that when the building continues to move, it's the systems that are at risk. They're continually finding that a sewer pipe will break or a water line will break because the structure is moving. Electrical fittings are pulling out of the conduits are pulling apart. Those are the types of things that we need some contingency money available. Some money available to fix while we're going to do the design on the long-term fix. So I think those are the dollars. And what that number is, you know, who knows what's coming down the pike. But, you know, the governor took a stab at a number, and that's what it is.
Mr. Co-Chair, I know has a question.
Thank you. Just real quick, Mr. Speaker, before you leave, and I think Margaret's out there, but Is this your last official legislative talking about prisons in front of JAC?
I have one more thing to do next week.
Mr. Speaker, it might be your yeah. I thought you wouldn't lose your opportunity. Remember your last day, I think, in the chamber here. I slip Mr. Squeaker in there, just as I've tried to do affectionately with all speakers. But I just wanted to say to you and Margaret, probably be your last opportunity in front of Joint Appropriations, but Margaret, of course, served in the legislature, Carbon County, and and of course, so both of you, and particularly Mr. Speaker, really appreciate your leadership, and you've done a great job, both of you, so appreciate your service. So thank you. No, you got to go. I might add that the speaker is also an alum of Natrona County High School. Go Mustangs. Okay, Mr. Co-Chair, can I just have a question about prisons?
Sure.
I just want to go back, Senator Pappas, about the time frame, and I think Representative Nicholas asked it 10, 15 minutes ago, but about the 50-year, we keep hearing the 50-year number, and with maintenance could go longer. And let's just talk, is the 50 years from the point of the fix, or the 50 years is from when this prison first went into service to get the next 20 years out of it?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the intent of the report said it would get the lifespan of the building back, which was intended to be 50 years. So another 34 years. I think we've been in there 16 years. But I believe, and the engineers believe, there's no reason why it couldn't be 50 years from this point of the fix. The structure is a concrete reinforced structure with many of it are precast, like the cells, and then there's steel roofs and beams. And all of that, the lifespans could go for as long as they're maintained. There's really no reason to have an end life. Typically, the end life will be because the program is not suitable anymore. The space is not suitable for your program. So mechanical systems can be replaced. Electrical systems can be replaced. Everything can be rejuvenated with maintenance. It's not like it's a wood structure that's going to weather away.
Thank you. And I understand, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure when we're talking 50 years, we're really talking 50, and that's a classic term with a certain level of major maintenance, that 50 on a new one and another 34 on this one. Really, and we understand what your point. So thank you.
Okay. Just a moment. Senator Burns, then Representative Burkhardt.
About that contingency, I was wondering if I think I read the other day that there was a lockdown there for some situation. I was wondering if Bob might come up and explain what happened.
Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to do that during our testimony on the budget.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it relates to what we're talking about now.
You have no choice.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Lampert, Director of the Department of Corrections. In regards to the lockdown, we had a situation where we had some displacement of slider doors in the corridor system. It was a combination of wear on the guiding system and also removal of some locking mechanisms because of building movement. The doors were closing. However, they could be manually pushed open, overriding the closure system if enough people pushed on the door. So as a security precaution, until we could put locks that lock the doors secured so it can't be pushed open, we went into a modified lockdown where we restricted inmate movement. That lasted for 36 hours. It was 18 out of 48 doors that had been compromised that have been repaired.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that was pretty much my question, Bob. But a little further, is that due to new movement or the existing movement?
Mr. Chairman, that I can't answer in regards to, we didn't know it was a problem until we were doing some routine maintenance on the doors. frankly, we had a former locksmith that decided rather than trying to continue adjustments on that locking mechanism, they just removed the locking mechanism and didn't tell anybody. So.
Is he still employed?
He is not still employed, but after a period of time when we were doing regular door maintenance, we discovered that the locking mechanism wasn't on the door. And so we immediately began to ask questions on why and determined that that had been a corrective measure due to building movement rather than trying to come up with a different solution. So we have a firm on contract with us, Sierra Detention, that's been working on door issues that we called back in and had them help us come up with a solution. And so as far as I know, that solution's working and in place. We began with some manual locks, and that did require us to put additional staff on to man those manual locks. So we did have a bump in overtime during that repair period, but I believe that's all been resolved.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. So I guess it bothers me that an employee took it on themselves to remove door locks at the state penitentiary. Have you changed procedures or anything to prevent that from happening again? While we thought it was maybe a little humorous, and a very serious matter to me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and we certainly take it as serious as well. Normally, all that maintenance work is well managed, well monitored. Frankly, this occurred at a time when we had difficulty hiring maintenance staff. Some of the work was being done by individuals contracted to come in. So there's no excuse for the lack of oversight, but certainly it's something that we have taken corrective action in regards to.
Okay. Senator Landon, then Senator Greer, or Representative Greer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Director, I just had a quick question with regard to major maintenance. We'll be talking today and tomorrow quite a bit about that subject. And in reading through a couple of reports and visiting with some folks I know with regard to structure and whatever, it's been indicated to me that some of the issues do relate to maintenance, as Senator Papp has pointed out. Have we not adequately funded major sorts of maintenance dollars for the penitentiary? And when we talk about expansion joints that haven't been addressed, or we talk about, you know, drifts of snow that don't get pushed back away from buildings, can you speak a little bit about that? Have we been shorting major maintenance dollars over there?
Mr. Chairman, no more than other state facilities in regards to deferred maintenance. I will say that part of our lack of carry through on preventative maintenance has been because of a lack of staff in terms of our inability to hire skilled staff and having to instead rely on some contract performers to come in and do regular maintenance work, which delays the performance of the preventative maintenance. Certainly, if we were fully staffed there's a new warden at the penitentiary who's looking at the option of working inmates as part of the maintenance crew, provides additional manpower under supervision, which I believe will address those issues as well. So in terms of the snow against the building, it is part of the concern. However, the overall grading and which it would be addressed in mitigation as part of the repair process would certainly assist in that, because it would give a concrete sidewalk, if you will, 10-foot sidewalk adjacent to the building, which doesn't exist at this time. So moving any snow away from the building now is moving it on dirt or gravel surface, which is a lot more difficult.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Greer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I apologize for being late, but I couldn't be in two places at once. Mr. Co-Chair, you know my opinions on the task force and our findings. Is this the appropriate time to discuss that? I know we got limited time.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. I mean,
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
But well, I don't know what your opinions are, but I hope they're short.
They're actually not. They're actually not short. And one of that is, so we appropriated funds to build out the shell in Torrington, which got put on hold. And we've got space there to handle a certain level of prisoner. And so I went through all the minutes of the committee and emailed the committee my concerns on where they were going. And what I didn't see was the discussion, which was the second part of the equation. First part of the equation is, yeah, you had all the engineers present all the information and tell you what happened and what was causing it, and this is what it was going to cost to fix it. But the second part of that equation was what our health facilities task force did. And that is what is a 30,000-foot view of how we need to manage the prison population in the state of Wyoming? And so I didn't see anything on the discussion of what can we do to build out the shell that's existing in Torrington, where we actually have a better chance of getting the prison guards hired, where we're having a difficulty in Rawlins. What are we talking about on costs to, or where do we need, what are the number of beds at what level of security do we need for those beds? Can we sit and save the max security pod that's available there and continue to use that in Rawlins? Or do we need to build a max security pod, a new one in Rawlins that's scaled down? The use of split sentences, I mean, we found that to be a very effective and efficient way to help with our prison population in the state. It also gives a back benefit to our local communities. Also, the cost of any overflow or excess that goes out. Was there an analysis of how many beds we need? Any of that. And I didn't see it in any of the minutes. And I was not able to attend those meetings. And so I guess, Senator, I'd just ask if you could address those concerns.
Well, certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A lot of the concerns that you brought were discussed. We did discuss the idea of briefly discuss the idea of building out Torrington. I believe that the inmate populations are certainly different between Torrington and the Wyoming State Penitentiary. I don't know how many beds are on the build out.
144.
So there's 144 beds, and we're talking about a population in the 500 and
well, 700. 700 total.
Total beds?
Population.
Okay. 700 versus the only 150 build, 160 build-out that we could have done in Torrington. So to the committee, and at least to me, it appeared that we still had to deal with Rawlins. We still had to deal with the state penitentiary. And so the issue was not that we could just shut it up and go somewhere else. Unless we built a new prison, we would have to do something with. If we were going to stay in Rawlins, we would have to do either build a new prison to the north, or we would have to correct the facility on in the south. Whether we even did build out the 160 beds in Torrington, the issue we had back to Representative Conley's. Thoughts on why we didn't fulfill the expanded mission, we really did not have the time. We did break into a subcommittee. A subcommittee was appointed, and the subcommittee met numerous times just to get done what we were able to get done. We were on an extreme tight time frame. So I'm sure there's a lot of things that could have been looked at. Frankly, we didn't have the time to do it.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator, I fully appreciate that because, as we all know, we got other jobs and other duties. But I still think that analysis of what is a reasonable amount of beds at what level of security that we need for the state of Wyoming. We can contract out of state with that overflow if there is a bump. We don't have to have beds at the maximum amount of expected prisoners. We need to find that average. We need to see what we can do to get them at that point. Who can go to Torrington? Okay, and we've been in this committee and there are other committees that know the benefits of what the treatment and the things that are available in Torrington. We also all know that the Constitution requires a prison in Rawlins. I'm not saying we don't do that. But it's also my understanding that the max security pod's not our problem. And then again, I go back to the split sentencing. great program. It's very cost effective and has benefits all around the state. And so I appreciate the fact you didn't have enough time, but I didn't see, if you had those discussions, I didn't see any conclusions or any empirical data or anything put to sight on that. And that was the second part of the equation, not just listening to the engineers.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond in part, testimony was given to the task force in regards to prison population needs and projected growth. And I will discuss some of that during the budget discussion. Bottom line is that we need the beds that we have to meet the population that we have. We are 94% of operating capacity at this time. We're projected to grow an additional almost 300 beds by the year 2020, assuming that there's no changes in policy. And again, I will talk about some of that during our budget discussion. I would like to say that in order to avoid out-of-state rental costs, the DOC came up with a plan to use temporary beds and emergency beds for any inmates that are displaced during the repair process, as well as to also absorb the projected growth in population until completion of that repair. So that causes us some concern in regards to it's difficult to manage 105% of capacity with limited numbers of beds, particularly if you take some of those beds off the line. But we are prepared to do that. I would also like to mention just in regards to the task force and to clarify a few other questions, the task force and the governor's office did approve expenditures of some of the funds to more immediately replace the electrical room at WSP, repair the gym wall, which is a source of the most movement, as well as to provide some compaction grouting under K-unit and CPF, which is where it's settling. That process is underway. While I initially thought we would be able to justify bid waiver to make that happen, we've determined that it'd probably be better to go through the bid process. So that's been delayed somewhat. We hope for an expedited process, but again, because of additional attention on bid waivers and sole sourcing, we decided to go through the bid process. So that matter's moving forward, but hasn't been completed. But assuming those immediate needs are addressed, we're fairly comfortable that we would probably get 1 to 2 more years of service out of the existing facility without additional repairs, which would give the legislature some time to consider the options. Frankly, we are supportive of repairing the facility at Rollins, primarily because we need the beds. And I'll go through those numbers again during my budget presentation. So I would stand for any other questions in regards to the task force.
All right, yes.
Just real quick, and more of a heads up than anything. I think what Representative Connolly, Representative Greer were talking about is basically sentence reform. And the Judiciary Committee has been working on that. In the interim, they have a bill coming this session.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not talking about sentence reform. I'm talking about an overall plan that covers all aspects of that. That's what I'm talking about. Split sentences aren't sentence reform. They're just another means of incarceration. Sentence reform is not a bad thing to look at. I'm not saying that, but I want a full picture of this before we start plowing in $80 million to $100 million on something.
Mr. Chairman, there's one other point that Representative Greer had raised that I forgot to address, and that is in regard to the configuration of our population from a classification standpoint and how many could be housed at WMCI versus WSP. Frankly, if we had additional beds at WMCI, we could add some security hardware to the cells and make a high custody unit out of what exists there. But it's designed to be a programming unit, and it's not designed to be high custody. On the other hand, WSP, which was designed to be high custody can be used to house all levels of offenders or inmates, including minimum. We just have to modify the way that we treat them. So the design, and we don't have the programming space I'd like to have there in terms of additional space for education, vocational education, cognitive behavioral programming and all that. But we make do, and we would continue to make do. Our need is bed space. And I'm not in support of open dormitory-style housing that other states use. I've been in systems that have that. It doesn't work well. It causes safety concerns and security concerns for the inmates as well as the staff. That's the least expensive form of housing for prisons, but it's not one that I favor. So the most economical approach is to repair the existing beds, and we will modify our operations to meet that need. Whether those beds are at WMCI, if we added beds at WMCI, the reason that $13.5 million was removed and not pursued was because that comes with an ongoing operating cost of between $6 and $8 million per year to operate those beds once they're open. Senator Burns did mention the criminal justice reform. It does do some things that would expand alternatives to incarceration as well as the use of existing alternatives to incarceration. But it comes with an appropriation as well.
Okay. All right. So at this point in time, maybe we should take a 5-minute JAC stretch, and we'll allow Director Lampert to get his troops in order, and we'll go into budget number 80, Department of Corrections. Okay. Huh? What? So we're going to have a little change in plans. I want to let you know that we're supposed to meet, I think, at 11 in L54 concerning Medicaid. You're going to be broke up into some components here, it sounds like, as we're behind schedule. But we also need to go into executive session at this point in time to discuss some legalities and with the prison. And so I think the Attorney General's here and whatnot. We'll meet in this room right here at this time, and then we'll come back to you, Bob.